ಪುಷ್ಪಕಂ ಯಜಾಮಹೆ ಸುಗಂಧಿಂ ಪುಷ್ಟಿವರ್ಧನಂ ಕುರುವಾರುಕಮಿವ ಬಂಧನಾನ್ ಮೃತ್ಯೋರ್ಮುಕ್ಷ್ಯಾಮೃತಾತ್. ಓಂ ತ್ರಯಂಬಕಂ ಯಜಾಮಹೆ ಸುಗಂಧಿಂ ಪುಷ್ಟಿವರ್ಧನಂ ಕುರುವಾರುಕಮಿವ ಬಂಧನಾನ್ ಮೃತ್ಯೋರ್ಮುಕ್ಷ್ಯಾಮೃತಾತ್. ಓಂ ತ್ರಯಂಬಕಂ ಯಜಾಮಹೆ ಸುಗಂಧಿಂ ಪುಷ್ಟಿವರ್ಧನಂ ಉರುವಾರುಕಮಿವ 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 ಬಂಧನಾನ್ ಮೃತ್ಯೋರ್ಮುಕ್ಷ್ಯಾಮೃತಾತ್.
ಗುಡ್ ಆಫ್ಟರ್ನೂನ್, ವೆಲ್ಕಮ್. Good evening, good morning, welcome. I'm really happy to be here with you for our first full Q&A of this course, this call. And we've already gotten a couple of questions which Deb has offered me. I want to just start, though, with a very simple meditation practice just to get us all into a holy mood, if you will. So find yourself a posture. Again, sit bones grounded, spinal column lifting, inhaling down and letting the base of the body become heavy, exhaling upward, letting the body lighten and rise. And put your hands on your solar plexus, just below the heart. Either the right hand on the solar plexus, the left hand on top of it, or both of them. And if your tummy's feeling a little bit trembly, or, you know, some of the ways that tummies feel that are not completely comfortable, place both hands over the solar plexus and just let yourself feel what's there. Listen to your breath. And if you're anything like me, it's not that easy to hear the inhalation, but you can make a sound with the exhalation. And with the exhalation, have the thought, have the intention, let go. And we will chant seven ohms. And the way we're going to do it is to focus on a different part of the body with every intonation of ohm. So, and I'll indicate which part of the body we'll be focusing on. So begin with the feet, just bringing your awareness fully to the feet. inhaling. Inhaling and bringing your awareness into the calves. The knees and thighs. The whole area of the pelvis, focusing in the lower pit of the pelvis. The solar plexus. The region of the mid-chest. And the center of the head. And then a big inhalation, a long exhalation with the thought, let go. And we can begin with the questions. And I think we'll start, Deb, with anything that you've got that's coming on the web page. And again, hello, everybody. It's really lovely to be with you. So, Deb, is there anything?
If we could give them just another minute. Apparently,
sure.
Website was wrong. I apologize. I thought I had the right one up. But,
oh, no problem.
I've got it
no
fixed.
Problem.
And I'm okay, just giving so. A few people that hopefully will recognize
right,
that.
Get it.
I got the wrong one. Yes. I'm so sorry.
No worries. No worries. It's part of the life of the internet. Right?
I tell you, and I swear I tested it.
I believe you. So a couple of questions have come in, which came into the listserv, and one of which you forwarded me. So one of the questions was whether it is time to delve further into our practice of Tonglen, and I'm completely happy to do that. A lot of the questions are focused on Tonglen, and one question arose, and I also felt very connected to this question, and some of you may have read Susan Dolander's share on the listserv, and it was about driving home from a trip, passing through Texas, and passing a pen where cattle were being kept crammed side by side. And, you know, if you've ever been in one of those, near one of those cattle pens, near a slaughterhouse, you know how really terrible it is. And so Susan said that she began to apologize to them, but she apologized to their spirits, and she was feeling a physical pain in her heart as she breathed in their suffering and tried to breathe out compassion. And so what she did was call on the goddess Kuan Yin and felt her at her back. And I want to say that this is a practice of bringing a deity energy, a deity presence. Kuan Yin, of course, is a very beautiful presence to bring into your Tonglen because she is so much the goddess of compassion. And some of you may have even practiced this with me, but when you breathe in suffering, especially extreme suffering that you're seeing with your own eyes, which obviously makes it much more visceral than what we imagine. Breathe it in through your heart and have the feeling that Goddess is behind you, is holding you from behind, and your heart is a conduit through which you breathe in that pain, you know, the pain of suffering animals, the pain of suffering humans. Breathe it into the Goddess's heart, and then allow yourself to be a conduit for her extraordinary divine compassion moving through your heart and into those beings. I agree with Susan that when we're looking at major, major, major collective suffering, it does feel too big for one heart. Though I know there are people who have done this practice over years and have found, and this has been my practice, my experience in the, you know, the relatively small amount of time that I have spent doing Tonglen practice. I do it regularly. I've done it for years, but I don't do it to that extent. But what does happen is that your heart begins to expand, begins to extend. And the more you begin to feel your small heart connected to the great heart, which, as Susan suggested, you can do fairly easily or fairly, let's just say quite powerfully, by imagining the presence of a higher being, of a deity, of a goddess, of a sage, of a saint behind you, and allowing their expanded heart to draw in the grief or the suffering, and then allow the compassion, that profound and vast compassion that comes from really the highest realms of our subtle universe, to flow through your heart into them. So that's really one of the great ways there is to practice with Tonglen when it feels overwhelming, is to really bring forth the presence of deity behind your heart, behind your body, and allow that the energy of deity, whether it's Kuan Yin or Shiva or Lalita or Durga or Mother Mary or Buddha or Christ, allow that energy to flow through your heart with its compassion. So if anyone has a question on this practice, I'd love to hear it. Otherwise, we'll return to it over time. So does anyone have anything you'd like to speak or ask? Yes, hi.
I do have, Karen asked this question, and maybe this is the one I forwarded over to you about the Tonglen practice, so I think you talked about that one.
Yes.
But okay, so I have another question here. Is the journey of souls true to you?
Is the journey of souls, you mean the book? Well, I don't know what you mean, Laurel, but I will say there is a book called Journey of Souls, which I like very much, actually, which is the account by a hypnotherapist of a group of patients whom he hypnotized over a period of time and who described life in let's call it the intermediate world, what we could call the after-death Bardo, in which, and described it quite minutely, in which people or souls actually found themselves in, I would call them pods or soul group pods of peers, where they received guidance, had conversations with each other, debriefed their past lives on Earth. It does seem to me to be true in the sense that any after-death realm is true, because I think one of the things that we have to realize about the after-death realms is that they are essentially mental realms. They are realms of mind. And so to a very large extent, at least this is my my conclusion, partly based on my experience, but also based on my understanding about what the subtle world is like. That is, when there are the cultural expectations and conditions and value systems of our times and place will tend to, let's say, create templates for the after-death experience, the post-death experience. And part of what I've been presenting to you is overviews that come from very reliable sources. The data from the Journey of Souls, let's call it a lineage, doesn't have what I would call scriptural authority in the same way that, for instance, the Tibetan Book of the Dead or Sri Yukteswar's account of the higher realms or some of the Upanishads. The Journey of Souls account doesn't have that level of, let's call it, time-tested scriptural authority. But I think it's very possibly true. I think it's actually a very interesting way to look at the after-death realm, especially for people like ourselves who are essentially on what we could call an evolutionary path, a path of moving through experience, understanding that it may take many lifetimes to assimilate all of our experience. But most of us here, I would say pretty much everybody who's on this call and in this course, has spent many lifetimes of practice, many lifetimes of aspiration, and it would seem to me to make a lot of sense that we would, as groups of souls, and there's quite a lot of, let's say, textual testimony from the different traditions about the existence of soul groups, it would seem likely to me that at a certain point there would be a recognition that a learning in that the post-death world would be a learning environment. And given the level of, you know, quite profound psychological sophistication that many souls leave their bodies with in modern times, it would make sense that a more sophisticated, more peer-oriented, more growth-oriented, obvious environment would become something that many people experienced. So that would be my answer to that.
Okay. We have a question from Loring. He says, please, in contemplating the next step in leaving this hell planet, I wish to find heaven on earth. But considering this here now, according to the tantric perspective, this is the divine life. Does the tantric view trump the Western conception of duality of heaven and hell? And where does evolution of consciousness fit in with this?
Let me just try to give you my own perspective. I would say that the Western concept of heaven and hell is highly dated. I think it comes from a misunderstanding about karma. And, pretty much belongs to a mythic viewpoint that is, I don't think, really profoundly useful at this point in time. The Eastern traditions, again, as you know, we've said this a lot over the course of this class, the Eastern traditions do seem to agree that there are places in the afterworld where you can sort of relax and have cooling drinks brought to you and friendly souls, basically psychologically fanning you. In other words, what we would call heaven realms, reward realms, and that there are also places where we kind of work through our difficult karmas, But the thing that they all agree on is these are not permanent environments. They're actually learning places, and I think that in a tantric vision of the world, and again, there's fundamentalist tantra, which essentially says that only this world is real. That is not what the tradition says. It's what some contemporary teachers of tantra say, and I honestly, again, speaking from my experience, I think to have the view that only this physical realm is the realm of Shakti is really an indication of one's lack of experience of the subtle realms, not an expression of truth. So, yes, one of the great, great truths of Tantra, and one that is very compatible with our modern understanding, is that this world can be a paradise, and as one of my teachers used to say, we have an obligation to make it a better paradise because, you know, in many ways, as a natural planet, it kind of is a paradise. It's just what we humans have done on it could use quite a bit of improvement. But my experience and my reading of Tantra is that there's an extremely wide range of experience, some of it very, very subtle, and some of it quite physical, all of which can be understood as aspects of Shakti, of the divine cosmic energy manifesting as experience, as reality. But, Loring, if you remember our study of the Pratyabhijna Hridayam and the first sutra of the Pratyabhijna Hridayam, the doctrine of recognition, which says that supreme consciousness, Chitti Shakti, manifests this universe on her own screen in absolute freedom, becoming everything that could exist and even those things which we can't conceive of existing. So really speaking, there's nothing outside the field of Shakti. There is ultimately nothing more real within the field of Shakti and nothing less real, because ultimately everything that appears within the field of Shakti, within the field of consciousness, is going to dissolve back into it. Since one of the foundational tantric ideas, and it's very much a part of the teaching in the Pratyabhijna Hridayam and the Shiva Sutras, one of the fundamental tantric ideas is that everything that arises in this universe arises as an appearance, as an emanation inside consciousness. And, you know, on this plane, it's extremely dense and gives the impression of being a universe of separate objects. But as you know, when we go to sleep and go into the dream state, this universe disappears and a mental universe arises, which is much more fluid, much more transparent, much more evanescent. And because the sages of Tantra were very conversant with the different levels and realms of consciousness, they were able to understand the way in which this dense physical universe is real and deserving of profound attention and love, and also is not permanently real, is evanescing. So I don't see a contradiction between experiencing this world as a potential paradise and recognizing that there are other subtler realms within which we arguably have as real an existence as we do here in this one. It's really not either or. And to oppose the, let's call it the transcendentalist idea of spiritual practice as an ascension out of the physical realm, to take that idea and oppose it to, you know, to one of the tantric understandings, which is that this physical world is also a sacred realm. I don't think those two ideas are opposed, and I think that there's a kind of duality that we inadvertently create when we say to ourselves that it's more important to focus on this realm than on the other realm, just as, you know, the opposite is a limiting idea. We live in all these dimensions, and if you're not living in the physical dimension now, you know, you will someday be living in the physical dimension. If you're living in the physical dimension now, you will someday, maybe tonight, be living in a full life in a more subtle dimension. So I think it's very important to hold all these together. And thank you so much for that question.
Okay, I have a question from Jane. She works in a healthcare anesthesiology in a busy urban hospital. Every patient that she meets is new to her. In the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita, I put my best efforts forward, intellectual, physical, and spiritual, including compassion and care with loving and kindness, and let go of the results. Regarding the Tonglen practice, is there a functional limit to compassion? She questions, if I am constantly offering an outbound flow of compassion to patients and coworkers, how do I maintain the integrity of my own energetic boundaries? Or is my understanding off, she says.
That's a very beautiful question. And
that's so
answer, yeah, it's a great question. And I would say anyone who's a caregiver, of, you know, whether in a situation like yours or with a family member or a friend, is going to face that question. And I think that in practicing outgoing compassion, we always have to keep coming back to practicing compassion for ourselves along with it. In other words, if you're sending blessings to another person, periodically you need to stop, so to speak, close out that other person and begin to breathe in compassion into your own heart for yourself, to take your own, you know, to pay attention to the feelings in your body, to pay attention to this, the stress feelings in your heart, breathe them into your heart, and really, really offer compassion to yourself. There's a note here from Jackie, who is hopefully on this call and is whom I've asked to answer some of the practical questions that might come up. And this is what she wrote. Some of you will have read it on the listserv. She said, in practicing Tonglen this week, two breath techniques merged that have helped me when I fear or feel I'm taking on another's suffering. Breathe in divine love, breathe in compassion, breathe out any negativity that I'm ready to release. Breathe in another's dark smoke of suffering, breathe out love, compassion, and light, and repeat. And so this is another version of what I just suggested, is that you do Tonglen for yourself as much as you're doing Tonglen for someone else. And this sequence that Jackie suggests is great. You know, you breathe in love, you breathe out negativity, then you breathe out the other person's suffering, negativity, and you breathe out love. So in this way, you continue to fill up your own vessel, you know, to fill up your own resource by breathing in compassion for yourself. So I think that's a very beautiful way of working with that apparent dichotomy. Jackie, do you have anything you want to say about this practice of caregivers, compassion, and burnout, et cetera, that you'd like to add to this? This is Jackie Robb, who's...
I'm hoping Jackie just raised her hand. Is that you, Jackie?
I did.
Okay, well, okay, good.
Perfect.
So thank you, Sally, for this class. I love what someone wrote just recently, that you could talk about toast and we would be fascinated and transformed. I love that. I don't have a simple answer to that question. I think it evolves. There are times when caregivers get overwhelmed, absolutely. And then we just need to do whatever it takes to come back to ground again. And And if we don't, we will crash and burn and we will become toast.
Yeah, yes, well said. Go ahead.
So whatever that takes, and I know in a hospital setting, I trained partly in a hospital, and it comes fast and furious, and you don't know people, and you're coming in basically blind to their content, what their language is, but it sounds like you're coming in very knowledgeable as to their unspoken, what's going on unspokenly.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, thank you. And that it's. I think one of the things about the way that caregiving is set up, and I think it's probably been that way throughout human history, is that the caregiver feels, and probably everyone around, generally feels that the sick person, the person in the midst of the emergency, should be the focus of attention. And so people who are in caregiving roles just tend to overstretch in the attempt to fill the need. And it's almost as though the whole society needs to retrain ourselves to recognize that someone who gives care in any situation actually needs a huge amount of support and self-care. And that means discernment about our own state and willingness to actually be willing to take the time to take care of ourselves. So, yeah, thank you.
You
yes.
Ready for the next question? Okay.
Yes.
This is from another Jane in Toronto. She says, grief has come up around an estrangement from my son this Christmas. I know that he is going through a difficult time with his young family and his relationship with his partner, and I'm definitely on the outside of this. I have been doing a Tonglen practice for us both, but now feel so called to do a practice for his immediate young family as almost a fifth person. Is this distancing from a painful situation?
No, I think it's probably a genuine calling, and you should honor it. You know, the thing about these practices is that when we begin doing a practice as rich and as powerful as Tonglen, especially with a family member or in a personal situation, insight and inspiration is going to keep coming up about how to extend it, when to stop it, you know. One of the things about this practice, as several people have shared, is that it just brings up a lot of what we're afraid of personally, of our own grief. So if you're being moved to do Tonglen for his family, I would say that you should look at that as a genuine inspiration. So yes, thank you for the question, and thank you for the practice.
So Laurel has a follow-up to the original question. She said, thank you for your helpful answer on the journey of the souls. She wonders, have you explored past life regression hypnosis for yourself? Do you find hypnosis helpful for healing or for evolving, for opening visionary portals? If so, how might you recommend working with hypnosis wisely or guard against unhelpful or unwise use of hypnosis? She says, I'm writing a new self-help hypnosis script and welcome the beautiful, wise way you guide us. Thank you deeply.
I honestly, I mean, I have done past life regression hypnosis. I will be absolutely honest. I cannot tell the difference between what is a genuine image of a past life and what is my own very active imagination. So I have found that interesting data comes up in those sessions, and you know, you may be a very, very skillful hypnotherapist or follower of self-hypnosis. I regard most of what comes to me in these kinds of sessions, including the ones I do with myself, as data, not necessarily as the truth. And so self-hypnosis, to me, is a powerful meditation technique that can be very, very useful and helpful in helping us journey into the subconscious. It may take us back to lives before this one. I have never personally experienced wisdom arising from such a session about a past life that I fully trust. So that, you know, so I just have to speak to you as an agnostic. And I know many people who work with hypnotherapy and self-hypnosis and swear that they've experienced profound insight and healing, and I honor that. But so I think if you're writing a script for self-hypnosis, that you should be very gentle, keep the induction slow, and be clear about where it is that you want to go, but not necessarily assume that that's where you're going to, that's where you're going. In other words, you may come into a hypnosis session as into a meditation session with a particular agenda or, you know, a question, and what arises may be wisdom about, or data or information or you know, visionary material about something that doesn't seem related, but which may be what your unconscious wants to produce for you at this moment. And I fully believe that when we journey into the unconscious, whether the personal unconscious or the collective unconscious, that there's tremendous value in that. Whether the information we receive is factually accurate in the sense that it describes something that that actually happened in real life at some point in your past, I don't think we can ever really know that. And that said, there are certain experiences that we all have with which come to us with a very strong sense of conviction. And if you have a conviction that something you've experienced in such a session is true, then go for it. I think it's always wise to take the material that arises in self-hypnosis or hypnosis by another with a few grains of salt. And if you can do that, if you can remain appropriately agnostic about it, and then notice what the effects are of hearing or visualizing or experiencing certain material in a hypnosis session, there's a lot that you can get from opening yourself to that kind of material. What I would never advise doing is getting seduced by it, taking it super seriously, and using it as a guide for your present and future life. So I hope that answers your question, my dear.
Okay, we have a question from Shelley in New York. She says, what is it that sweeps out of the body as I fall asleep? Is it subtle body or soul? If it is subtle body, what is it doing? Where is it going? And likewise, if it is the soul. She says she has experienced this once, watched herself fall asleep, looked at herself, lifted up her hand and slapped herself on the face to wake up. So she'd know what had happened. It scared her, so she hasn't allowed herself to witness it again. Can you speak about this and how to navigate it?
Well, what you experience, Shelley, is one of the classic entrance points into lucid dreaming. So it's a state that people try to cultivate, especially advanced sadhakas. It's what you experienced is one of the results for people who have really followed the path of lucid dreaming. In other words, if you can remain conscious through the process of transitioning out of waking into dream, you will sometimes feel this, as you say, this whoosh, as the As the spirit lifts out of, you know, let's say, being fully identified in the body with entering into the subtle body, into the dream state, I know what you mean. And I would say that the way you navigate it now and, you know, and later on when your body, is dying and your soul is lifting off, is to realize that it's a natural phenomenon and see if you can just stay with it, see if you can just follow it. I would say the next time this happens, I wouldn't try to wake yourself up. I mean, sometimes what happens is not under our control, but I would just go with it. I mean, you've been there once, so it's not completely unfamiliar. You know, and I think working with an experience like this is a little bit like, I mean, the analogy I always use is mountain climbing or rock climbing, that, you know, when we're walking, when we're climbing a mountain, even on a path, and I usually climb mountains on paths. I haven't done the really intense stuff. But, you know, there's certain parts of the path that feel very narrow and kind of scary. And the first time you come across it, I at least will often turn back. And then the second time and the third time, because it's familiar, you follow the path and see where it leads. And I would say this is the thing to do with this sense of liftoff. It's your consciousness, your soul, that's moving from the physical body into the subtle body, which, as we've been saying, is a very, very big territory. But, you know, in your nightly travels, you're going into your own dream state, which is really a mental body that is part of your personal unconscious. And nothing bad is going to happen to you there, though, you know, very surprising and sometimes frightening things happen in dreams. It's a mental world. So because you, Shelley, have, you know, you do a lot of practice and you have, you know, you can navigate a lot of different levels of your meditative self, I would just have confidence that you can experiment here. You can follow it. It'll be useful and interesting. So thank you.
All right, we have a question from Brigitte in Berlin. She first starts off with a quote by Tony Packer, but no self is not a concept or an entity. It is a state of immediate, undivided awareness presence. So then she goes on to ask her question. First one is, if all is one great consciousness, vibrating energy, and there is no soul or ego, how does this recognition fit with the idea or concept of reincarnation?
Well, the interesting thing is that the Buddhists who, you know, Buddha taught that there is no such thing as a permanent self. He also taught that the energy of the soul reincarnates. So this is another case of both are true. Ultimately, there is only one vast consciousness. Within that vast consciousness, infinite consciousnesses are arising and subsiding. And we, the more deeply we meditate, the more deeply we study the, you know, and this is, I think, very important, the more deeply we study the writings and the teachings of sages who have this experience, the more we begin to realize that we are not in a world of either or. We're in a world in which we move through multiple realities, and they are all real while we're in them. So it's just as much of a misconception to believe that because of the fact that all is ultimately one, nothing that occurs within this oneness is worth paying attention to. It's just as much of a misapprehension to believe that as to believe that the only thing that's real is what happens in the physical world. You know, that it's all part of the spectrum of consciousness. And we exist as we're multi-level beings. We have multiple levels of consciousness that our individual consciousness is capable of moving through. And that, to me, is, you know, one of the gorgeous things about studying these traditions is that we start to separate the bullshit from what really feels true, and we start to learn how to live with the overall recognition of non-duality, of the fact that ultimately there is one consciousness that's experiencing all this within itself, and that at the same time, you know, we are fragments of that consciousness, and when we are fully in our individual consciousness, then the world we experience is the world that, you know, that is created to mirror our individuality, and that is the great mystery. So thank you for that, and I really suggest that all of us take very seriously the truth that we are one, and that we're also many, and what that means, you know, what it means to hold the perspective that it's all one, and that everything that feels so dense and significant and important is ultimately an appearance. As Buddha says, it's a, you know, a dewdrop on a leaf. It's going to evanesce, just as our bodies are going to decay. So this particular slice of historical reality is going to change. And yet, as individuals inside this moment, we are, I use the word responsible advisedly because, you know, we're only partially responsible for our experience. But our choices and our actions as individuals are enormously consequential. So we get to marinate in those two parallel truths. So, Deb?
She also asks, why did the great one consciousness diversify?
Well, what they say is for fun. My first teacher of Kashmir Shaivism, who was an Indian Swami, and he used to say, he would give us his teaching. Of course, everyone always asks this question. So why does the one become many? He did it for sport. It is bliss for him, it's suffering for us, and then he would giggle. But that's you know, in Tantra, the view of reality, the view of the supreme reality, and it is a theistic tradition. So, you know, the supreme reality is not seen as a kind of abstract field of consciousness, but as an abstract field of consciousness, it also has a personality and a strong feeling base, and is capable of taking forms. Anyway, the teaching is that Shakti, the dynamic aspect of the Supreme Consciousness, becomes self-conscious, becomes aware of her own existence, and then has an automatic, which I think we all experience as miniature forms of consciousness, an almost automatic desire to do something with it, to make something, to create something, to, you know, to see what it would be like to have a thought and follow it through. So, you know, that the fundamental tantric idea about consciousness on whatever level is that it's fundamentally creative. And I personally find this, I find that this explains a lot, you know, as to why things are the way they are, because consciousness is so creative that, you know, sometimes it, we, she, he, you know, including our own consciousness, creates for the sake of love, for the sake of creativity, and then has to deal with you know, the unintended consequences of a particular creation. So, as my guru used to say, it is God's, I'm trying to remember his exact words because they're very cute, it is God's game, picnic, and sport. He does it out of love. And as my first teacher of Kashmir Shaivism would say, it's love for him, it's suffering for us, but behind it is love. So, what do we have?
I'm just going to remind everybody, if they have a question, they can raise their hand with a star 2. And
oh, yes,
I'm going to unmute somebody from Oregon.
Okay.
You had your hand raised?
Yeah. Hi, Sally. It's Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
How are you? Nice to hear your voice.
And back at you.
So I've been having, my son died. And,
right.
It's crazy. But what I wish this course would talk about more, or I just hope you could at least talk about it here a little bit, is that, you know, I've read, like, not just only The Soul's Journey. There's, like, a million of those Soul's Journey books, and I've read almost
right.
all of them. And there's actually a lot that's concurrent about what happens after we die. And I would agree
yes.
that what you've said about, you know, all these people on this call and all the people that have been learning from you for decades are already prepared for death. I think it's actually pretty easy when you get over there. But one thing I was hoping that the class would talk about, which is that I think the reason people are so afraid of death is because when we have to carry it on earth, you know, like, I think it's much harder to, like, hold death while you're living than it is to be the one who dies. Now, I don't know if that's true, but the idea of death is actually fairly inviting to me lately, especially with everything I've read about it, you know, that
right,
there is
right.
some real beauty about living and evolving without your body, and that I know my son has come and that his soul is still part of something greater, you know, so I don't feel afraid of death in that way. But living with the weight of grief that death brings is also a great divider. There's a way in
yeah.
which we can't culturally hold that space. And so
yeah.
you keep it as this secret. And
yes,
you know,
I get it.
It's changed me and my family in some exquisitely beautiful ways that I know we wouldn't be together in the way that we are. And so it's not that I am not grateful for that, but of course, it's kind of this irony because I would give that up to go back to how it was, even though it's much more functional in some ways now. We've had to tell a lot of truths, you know, so
yeah.
it's just like, how do we spiritually transform ourselves when we hold great loss? To me, that's the real epic question about death, because, like I said, I think when we die, we have all these guides and, you know, it seems way more fun than, like, holding on to his loss for the next however many years.
Well, I would say, and this is going to sound ruthless, I don't think you have to hold on to his loss. I actually believe that what you're saying about the way grief and loss opens us up sometimes to unbearable suffering, which I mean,
but also great
suffering.
Spiritual height.
Exactly,
incredible
great
spiritual
height.
Epiphany.
So why not feel grateful for the fact that you have been able to break through that, you know, the fake innocence of believing that everything is, you know, going to be okay in this life and come to really deep understanding and wisdom as a result, you know, that's part of the journey of the maturation of the soul. And and it's part of the way it happens. And I feel like we're asked to metabolize it, and you know how to do that. So,
but I don't
really
know what the spiritual practice of that is, you know? Like, maybe it's just something that happens to you, you know? And I feel like all these teachings you've been giving all these weeks, you know, they seem to me teachings for life, you know?
Well, they are totally teachings for life.
Right. And so it's like, what is the teaching about how to hold death, you know? I mean, I don't know. I mean, and maybe like you said, maybe the idea is that you're not supposed to hold it. Maybe it's this transformation that washes through you, and then you land at some other side at some point. But I think that's really why people are afraid of death. Not because of the dying, but because of the losing.
I think people are afraid of death because people are afraid of pain. And, you know, and dying is for many people painful. And yes, I think you're right. I think that the loss is something that we avoid, we find terrible, and we need to, as humans, come to terms with it. I mean, you're right. These practices are practices for life. They're also practices for helping us hold the pain and the horror of all the ways that we feel about death and loss. When someone close to you dies, it's a radical for the family. You know, it's a big hole in the family. And everybody in the family reforms around that hole, and everyone deals with it differently, as you know. But I do think a big teaching in loss, in dealing with the death of someone close to you, is actually learning to allow your dark emotions, you know, to not to feel that a dark emotion is something that shouldn't be happening and that you need to get rid of as soon as possible. And this is one of the reasons why the Tonglen practice feels so profound, certainly to me and to many people, is because it is a way of breathing in your grief, you know, letting yourself feel it, and then breathing love and compassion into yourself as a grief-stricken person, into your family, into the members of your family, into your son. And there's an alchemy that occurs when we don't try to distance ourselves from dark emotions. There's a deep healing that occurs that doesn't occur any other way. And alchemy is really the only name for it. Some people never recover. Some people,
I know, and it's like, I don't want to live in the world, because it's like all those people were writing on the listserv about, like, not wanting to reincarnate and, you know, wanting liberation from this world. And there were some beautiful things said about, like, just recently, you just answered that question about how beautiful the world is, this world, this physical world.
Yes.
And, you know, yes. I want to live in this world joyfully again. And
well, you will.
I don't know
you
how
will.
To pray it, for that. I don't know what the prayer is for that.
Well, I would say ask to grow through this. Ask to deepen through it. Ask to know, ask for wisdom, ask for your heart to get bigger. You know, you don't have to ask, you don't have to pray for outcomes. You know, you can pray for love, you could pray for depth, you could pray for healing. And also, you know, just to recognize those beings, those guides that we talk about in the after-death realms, they're here. It's not like they're only, they're only there behind the veil. They're absolutely here. So if you keep asking for healing and help, whether you call on Goddess or whether you call on personal guides or whether you call on your own higher self, you become aware of how much holding, how much help there is. So yes, it makes no sense. And yes, the practices that we do that I've tried to, you know, to hold space for us to do together. The reason this class is called The Path of Life and Death is because it's a continuum, you know, and the practices that prepare us for dying are the practices that let us live in a deeper, more expanded way. And, you know, your heart has been broken open, and painful as it is, this is never a bad thing. You know, it's the door to more love, more depth of understanding, and I know you know that.
You know, you said one thing to me, this is the last thing I'll say, that you never said it in the class, and I think it's really important when you told me about Krishna's promise that even people who are not prepared to die, that our prayers, like the living people's prayers for the people who left, is enough to, like, help them with their own karma. And
yes,
so that
yes.
seems like a really important thing that should happen in this class, that people know that.
I think we talked about it. I think we talked about it last week, but maybe not.
Maybe
not
I
enough.
Missed it.
But
yeah.
Yes, I agree with you. I think it's unbelievably important for us to remember and honor and pray for the people who have passed out of this world, including some we don't even necessarily know.
Yeah,
you know,
it was really helpful for me. So
yeah,
thank you for that.
I agree. Anyway, darling,
yeah.
thank you. And thank
yeah.
you for your willingness to, you know, just be so open with your experience.
Yeah.
So,
thanks, Alan.
Love and blessing, Wendy.
Thanks.
Are you ready for another question?
Yes. And
okay.
this will be the last one.
Okay. Gail asks, what is the difference between mind and the soul?
Well, the soul, you know, it's really a matter of semantics. In the tantric traditions, the understanding is that mind is the entire field of consciousness, including the field that's not in your body. Soul, in this tradition, is the individual package, the individual, you know, I call it slice of consciousness, that includes your personal mind, that moves through the wider field of consciousness, and is capable of opening up to and including it. So soul is the mind, but the mind that you have in this life is the mind, to some extent, that your soul brought in, but which is very much conditioned by where you are in society, by your genetic heritage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when we die, the karmic qualities of the mind dissolve, and what the soul takes with it are its... First of all, its innate qualities, its innate predilections, and those aspects of the karmic expectations, fears, etc., that it hasn't lived through in this lifetime, which are, as it were, attached to the body of the individual soul, along with its other instruments. So. There is no difference between the soul and the mind, but we use the word mind in English is we use it in all kinds of senses. So in Sanskrit, the word for mind that you're talking about, I believe, is manas, which is the part of the psychic instrument that reacts to stimuli and that, you know, that thinks. This is one of the instruments of the soul. It's let's say an adjunct of the soul, which, you know, the soul consists of all the psychic instruments, the karmic backpack, and the inner senses. And it operates in a world of consciousness, which because we don't have a lot of words in English, which we also call mind, but which is not the same as the mind that thinks, you know, that the sense in which soul and mind are the same, it does not mean that the soul is the same as that part of your consciousness that endlessly cycles through different thoughts and beliefs and concepts. That the soul is the field in which that aspect of the mind is thinking and conceptualizing and reacting to stimuli. So if you, you know, if you sort of draw back and feel into that in you which is aware of thinking, is aware of emotion, is aware of feeling, then you're in touch with the soul. You're in touch with the essence. And it is also a deeper level of mind. In Buddhism, they would call that a deeper level of mind, because in Buddhism, they don't have a word for soul. They consider it all to be mind. So everything is mind. The soul is an aspect of the great mind that has a unique, particular set of instruments and circumstances that make it an individual. And it, part of what it possesses is a faculty known in Sanskrit as the manas, which we usually call the mind, which is able to actually assimilate sensory experience, whether it's coming from the so-called outside world or from inside us, and which constantly comes up with ideas, impulses, reactivity to that. So that mind is an instrument. The soul is really the deepest existence that we have as an individual. So I hope that helps. I think one of the problems with discussing these subtle concepts is that there are so many ways in which we define the word soul and define the word mind. And the definition of soul in the Eastern traditions, I mean specifically in Hinduism, is similar to but not exactly the same as the way soul is defined in the Judeo-Christian traditions. And one of the reasons for that is that basically, you know, the Abrahamic religions, though they do have their non-dual mystical aspects, and certainly they're non-dual realizers in those traditions, but they're essentially dualistic, and they essentially believe that the soul is kind of an atom that is eternally separate from God, and then is eternally separate from everyone else. So when we come to these ideas, these tantric ideas, these non-dual ideas from a Western tradition, we also come with some, you know, some, let's call it semantic issues that actually means that we need to define what we're speaking about. So I thank you for that question, Gail. I want to say I will go into more of the Tonglen, more of the wisdom of Tonglen or the understanding of Tonglen on Wednesday's class. And if there are things other than what has come up tonight that you would like to be discussed further, I would love it if you'd, you know, send those questions in the next day or so, and we will do our very best to include answers to your questions to deal with, you know, obviously this is one of the biggest subjects in the world. We can't answer every question, but I very much do want us to feel at the end of this time together that our basic questions about how to meet death and how to live our lives with the awareness of death in such a way that our awareness of death deepens our lives and deepens our fearlessness and deepens our ability to work with our own emotions. So please, please, please send in any questions or suggestions. Thank you so much, Jackie, for being with us. Again, if you haven't read the documents that Jackie has given us, which are up on the course website webpage, I would really recommend that you do that. And I also want to recommend, just in light of what Wendy asked, a book called Healing Through the Dark Emotions. And I will put this on the reading list. It's by a writer named Miriam Greenspan. The subtitle is The Wisdom of Grief, Fear, and Despair. Her understanding of why it's so important to work with grief and fear and anguish and actually metabolize these death-related emotions is precisely because it is in working with these that our life and our character and our soul, if you will, takes on depth, matures, loses the innocence, which I think for many people, especially in the developed world, in the rich world, so many of us have a kind of innocence about some of the things that can happen in human life. And at some point we lose our innocence, and it's just as a child loses its innocence at a certain point and must lose his or her innocence in order to grow up. We also must and do lose our innocence, and sometimes this happens through a tremendously difficult life circumstance, but it's always in the service of deeper connection to the depths of our own soul and to those of the other beings that we meet in this world and the other realms where we live. So thank you so much for being on this call, and thank you for your questions. And we have another class on Wednesday, and I'm feeling that if there's still issues that don't feel resolved, that we'll do another Q&A with Debbie's Grace, either next weekend or during one of the weeknights of the week after next. But again, thank you, and thank you so much for being who you are and for being part of this exquisite group of souls and minds and hearts who are looking at these questions in such a deep way. And always thank you for everything that you're sharing, which is so profound. So let's put our hands over the heart. And drop into the breath. And feel with the inhalation that we draw in the qualities of hope, of love, of caring that holds this Sangham together, that we really draw in the light of each other's hearts into our own heart. And then with the exhalation, just let yourself feel that light, magnified by being held in your heart, is flowing out to everyone who's here together with us. So we draw in each other's presence, each other's joy and grief, each other's light, which is so powerful in this Sangham. We draw it in. We let it open our heart, and then with the exhalation, we offer that light, that blessing, in a very natural way. We allow it to seep out of our heart and out through our pores and appear as a blessing for every one of us. Thank you so much, and Thank you, Deb. Thank you, Jackie. Thank you, everyone who asked questions. Thank you, all of us who are listening and holding space. And we'll see you all on Wednesday. So much love. Good night. Deb, would you like to play the goddess chat for a minute or two? I'll relieve the call.
Yes, I'll turn it on.
Thank you. Yeah.